The moral dilemmas of artificial intelligence and our use of it.
If we think of artificial intelligence as holding up a moral mirror to humanity, how are we looking in that mirror? And what do we see when the figure in the mirror looks back at us? Are we, you know, inflecting our moral choices through these machines, in spite of these machines, with the help of these machines? And what is that going to look like in the years ahead? You know, how is it reshaping us as a species?
That's Bruce Holsinger. He joins us to talk about his gripping new novel, Culpability, a story of family, tragedy, and the moral consequences of artificial intelligence. Through the voice of a husband whose wife is an AI ethicist, Holsinger explores what happens when machines begin to mirror our deepest flaws. Then mystery icon Elizabeth George returns to Writer's Voice to discuss her latest Inspector Linley novel, A Slowly Dying Cause. It's a story steeped in grief, obsession, and deceit. And in George's signature style, it pulls us deep into the textures of place and the complexities of the human heart. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We last spoke with Bruce Holsinger in 2022 about his climate change-themed novel, The Displacements. His new novel, Culpability, spurs the reader to consider the ethical and emotional consequences of the use of AI by the deeply flawed human beings who shape it. The story begins with a devastating car crash involving a self-driving vehicle. From that ordinary tragedy emerges a meditation on moral agency, responsibility, and family. Holsinger's narrator, Noah Shaw, centers the story around that of his wife, Lorelei, a MacArthur-winning philosopher and AI ethicist whose research into ethical artificial minds collides with her own family's pain. The novel's title reflects a central question: who is culpable when AI goes awry? As AI systems begin to make decisions once reserved for humans, Holsinger asks whether these systems can truly learn ethics or only replicate our own flaws and biases. The story intertwines the philosophical with the intimate, exploring drone warfare, chatbox's companions, and the alien moral landscape of machine learning within the emotional cauldron of a family story. Ultimately, Holsinger tells us he thinks that moral responsibility still lies with us humans, no matter how powerful artificial intelligence becomes. Let's hear that conversation now. Bruce Holsinger, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Culpability, this is just a terrific book. As I told you before we began, I couldn't put it down, literally. It is about the ethical dilemmas that AI poses for us. It begins with a horrifyingly ordinary tragedy, a family car crash that involves a fully autonomous vehicle. Why did you use a car accident with an autonomous vehicle as a lens for exploring the moral dilemmas of AI, of which there are legion?
Yeah, so I began thinking about this as not connected to AI at all. It really was just a family getting through a car accident. I was thinking after my last novel, which was about climate change, it was called The Displacements. I was just thinking about and that was a family going through this massive national catastrophe involving the world's first Category 6 hurricane, as the novel imagined it. In this case, I was thinking, okay, well, a family going through another kind of calamity, a smaller scale one, a kind of everyday accident on a highway. And I was thinking about in the driver's seat is the oldest child in this family. He's 17. His name is Charlie. And I just thought, okay, what if everybody in that family in some ways felt themselves responsible for this accident? so that we're all culpable in some ways. And then it was really only after I was in the middle of a first draft, when I was thinking of introducing this element of a self-driving or autonomous car. And then when I finished the first draft, it was the fall of 2022, and suddenly ChatGPT exploded into our consciousness. Everyone in the world was talking about AI. And I finally understood what this novel was really about. It's not so much a novel about AI, it's about a family going through a really hard incident in their lives. But what the introduction of artificial intelligence did is it kind of thickened that story, made it more contemporary, made it more urgent in some ways. And so the AI kind of layered itself in as I was going along.
Well, you say it's a typical family, but it has at least one member who is not typical at all. The mother, Lorelei Shaw, is a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. She's a philosopher of ethics, and she's the author of a book within the book, Silicon Souls, on the culpability of artificial minds. So tell us about Lorelei Shaw.
Yeah, so Lorelei is a world-leading figure in the field of ethical artificial intelligence. And the book begins with her words from that book within the book, whose title that you just gave to your listeners. And writing her character, I suppose as I was going through the process of writing the novel, she became a kind of obsession for me in some ways, just as artificial intelligence is an obsession for her. We hear the story mostly through Noah's first person voice. He's her husband. He's the dad of their kids. And my last three novels, I guess my last four novels, have all been from multiple points of view, mostly in third person. And that's really the way I usually write. This time I'm focusing in on one perspective and letting him tell that story. He's not an unreliable narrator, but he is a bit of a clueless narrator, especially when it comes to Lorelei. She's unfathomable to him in many ways, the way her mind works, what she does with her days, her job. There's almost a way that he purposefully doesn't let himself know about what she's up to. And that plays very strongly into the plot later in the book. But I wanted to create this character who would, in some ways, once I understood what the novel was about, I created Lorelei to embody some of the anxieties that our world has with AI, that our society is grappling with. And she kind of crystallizes all those questions in her personality, in her mind, in her writing.
And she crystallizes it focusing on the ethical issue. I mean, I think there are other issues with AI that we can think about, not least of which is AI kind of us outsourcing our creativity and our intelligence to it. I have even noticed a perceptible loss of creativity when I've used AI, and so I try to use it as judiciously as I can. You really focus in on the moral issue here, and it's one that is around a very classic ethical problem, the trolley problem, which appears throughout the book, both explicitly and metaphorically. What is the trolley problem, and why did you choose to anchor the story in that classic moral dilemma?
So the trolley problem was developed by a British philosopher named Philippa Foot. And the idea, there's different forms of it, but the classic one is, let's say you're standing at a switch alongside the track of a trolley coming along. And if the trolley keeps going on its current track, it will kill three people that are bound to the track a little further down. If you pull the lever and put the trolley on another track, it will kill one person that is bound to that track farther down. So the idea is that if you do nothing, three people will die. If you do something, one person will die. What do? Do you pull that lever so that you're responsible for one person's death? Or do you throw up your hands and think of yourself as helpless? You didn't do anything. And three people died. And it's one of those, you know, it wasn't originally designed, of course, it was way predated self-driving cars, but it does make us think about the morality of ourselves in relationship to machines and how we intervene in the everyday kinds of dilemmas that machines are involved in. And so it's a, you know, AI systems, the kind of trillions of algorithmic decisions that a really complicated system like a self-driving car might be making. The trolley problem is much too simple to really capture the everyday dilemmas that those systems are dealing with. But it does illustrate the kinds of moral problems that people in that world, people who are programming algorithms, people who are inventing algorithms and thinking about the technologies of these kinds of machines, it does exemplify the kind of problems that they have to think about every day. So I thought it was a nice way to kind of illustrate the dilemmas that Lorelai is involved in and the central dilemma that defines what happens to the family at the opening chapter of the book.
Just to generalize it, are you saying that autonomous vehicles have to make the kinds of decisions, ethical decisions, that are implied in the trolley problem? I mean, could we see them making choices between killing people that they don't have within their area of concern versus the people who are, you know, their owners, so to speak, or to instead use other kinds of ethical things, like how they may kill their owners because there's only one owner and there may be 10 people in the road? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm more so, because I think choices and decisions are words that, those are very human kinds of words. And I think in the technology of self-driving cars, as I understand it, and believe me, I'm no expert here, but the research that I did, the people I interviewed, they're machine learning. They're learning from their own mistakes. The machines, the algorithms are designed to make them better and better and make smarter and smarter, even as I try to describe it, make smarter and smarter responses to the programs that are controlling them, right? And to make the process of being in one and being around one safer. And that represents the kind of dilemma that these machines embody.
You also bring up some other dilemmas, things that are very pressing, I think, to us as we see the incredible development of drone warfare, along with the increasing sophistication of AI. You know, the whole notion of war machines, basically, that will be autonomous warfare done by robots, where these ethical questions really do come up. How do you think about the issue of drone or other kinds of autonomous weapons?
Well, I think it's terrifying. I mean, what else could I say? I think we're at this point where these kinds of drone swarms that I imagine in the novel, and it only comes up a couple of times. I don't want to give spoilers about where it's involved in the plot. You know, those are just over the horizon, if they're not already on the horizon. And, you know, there are agencies working on them in many different parts of different governments. And one of the dilemmas in the book is, well, what if these drone swarms are more accurate in distinguishing combatants from civilians? Couldn't they be more moral than a human fighting force? Isn't it, aren't there aspects of these where the morality isn't black and white and they're just pure evil? And I suppose that's one of the things that Lorelai wrestles with. That's one of the things the industry is wrestling with. The morality of AI is not clear cut, and maybe warfare will be one of the places that bears that out.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bruce Halsinger about his new novel, Culpability. It's about AI, moral agency, and a family facing impossible choices. You speak in the novel of the black box of AI, and I was reading an article in the, I forget which, national newspaper yesterday about the fact that we really don't know why AI does make, if you can call it, make decisions, or how it will make decisions. In other words, AI is a black box to us. It could be a completely alien intelligence. Could it develop a completely alien ethical system?
Well, of course, yeah. And I think one thing that's alien about it is its indifference. You know, for all that we talk about the ethics of AI, the morality of AI, the systems themselves, and you say it, but it's them, and it's them by the hundreds of thousands now. And they're all different. They're all learning in different ways from from text, from image, from video, from our language, from the way we move in the world. They're all learning different things about us all the time, but they are completely indifferent to our fates. And to me, that seems one of their superpowers. It's often not recognized as such, but it's one of the most unsettling things about artificial intelligence systems is their lack of a moral framework. Even if one is programmed in to the algorithms, there will always be what experts in the field call the alignment problem, where they may elude our requests for them. They may misunderstand them. They may, you know, may solve a problem in a way that we hadn't understood they could. And so that's one of the ways that I think people who work in these systems imagine them getting out of control. But, you know, culpability it's really not a novel that's just about AI. It's also about a family. And as they're a family facing an everyday kind of tragedy and how to get around it. So I really wanted the artificial intelligence not to be secondary, just to be, you know, a dilemma that they were wrestling with as they go about their lives, as they're thinking about, you know, how they relate to each other, how the kids relate to each other, the parents relate to their kids, and all the kind of everyday dilemmas that families are facing.
Yes, but you actually made these questions about AI. I mean, this is what your novel so brilliantly does. You make it personal. You make it something that forces the reader to think about, okay, well, what would I do in that situation? Or how do I respond? You know, one of the novel's most memorable refrains is, a family is like an algorithm. I wanted to ask you, what did you mean by that? What is the import of it?
Well, it's not my position that a family is like an algorithm. It comes from the mouth of Lorelei, one of the characters. And so she, in the prologue, Noah is remembering this moment when she said, you know, how do we, he was asked, they were in a conversation, you know, how do we're so different? How do we do it? What's our secret sauce? How do we make our marriage work, our family work? And Lorelei says, well, a family is like an algorithm. There's inputs and outputs, and as long as everything's going along smoothly, the machine of the family is going to work as it should. And of course, Noah is very skeptical of that. He's not dismissive, but he's like, oh, I guess that's her way of seeing the world. And the story told in Culpability, I think, defeats that idea. And so maybe one of Lorelei's arcs is she has to learn that, you know, things are messy. A family is messier than that, and it's not an algorithm. So that's one of her, I guess you could call it her learning curves in some ways.
And another theme that runs through the novel is parenthood as both love and terror for the safety of one's children. And of course, the desire for safety is what's behind the notion of autonomous vehicles. You know, the vehicle at the center of this novel. And yet I'm totally terrified by the idea of an autonomous vehicle for myself or my children and grandchildren. So how did this theme of parenthood as both love and terror shape the book's moral landscape?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, that's how I think a lot of parents experience it. You know, you are, on the one hand, you have this boundless love for your kids. You would do anything for them. You would anything to, you know, help them get through our world. On the other, you're, you know, every time they leave the house and every time they're away from you, you're worried about getting a call, you know, maybe especially as they get older. And that gets really scary. You know, to go back to your point about autonomous vehicles, let me ask you this. When's the last time you were in an Uber? Have you been in an Uber before?
Never.
Never. Okay. Oh, so you haven't even been in like an Uber or a Lyft.
Yet my son is an Uber driver.
Oh, okay. Well, do you think you should ask him this? Do you think he looks at his phone while he's driving to get his next fare?
I actually don't think he does.
That's interesting. He would be the only Uber driver that I would ever hear about who doesn't. Because every time I've been in an Uber or a Lyft, you know, the driver has, you know, been spent time on their phone to get their next fare. And I think that's, you know, the job of a self-driving taxi like a Waymo in San Francisco or Los Angeles is to get you to your destination safely, not to find its next fare. And there have been studies of passenger hours in autonomous vehicles versus human-driven vehicles. And the safety incidents, there's just no comparison. So I think autonomy is going to be more and more about how cars are driven, how trucks are driven. And I know that, that inhuman intelligence makes it scary, but I don't know if it makes it less safe.
Right. And I'm not convinced that it does either. And the only reason I think that about my son is that he has really lit into me when I've even moved my hand towards my phone
Ah,
while
good
I'm
for him.
driving.
Ah, good for him.
So I think he's pretty careful about that. But yes, I take your point. I want to go back, though, to this issue of indifference of AI, because I do have to say that it was the AI implications, maybe because I'm thinking about them so much, that really gripped me. And a Lorelai, who's such a compelling character, asks whether we can train machines to be good in the same ways we train ourselves. And of course, we train ourselves with the idea of with consequences. I mean, that's supposed to be parenting 101, consequences, not abuse, but consequences. And yet, if these machines are indifferent, you do pose this issue. How do we train them to be good?
They don't. I mean, it's not my field. I don't really know how, I don't know the technicality of it. And but Lorelai has devoted her life to this. She's got a PhD in ethical philosophy, but she also has a PhD in computational engineering. And so she, has figured out all these ways to try to make them respond to our ethical systems. And you brought up that metaphor of the black box, which people in AI use to describe the unfathomability of these systems. And that's part of it. Even Lorelai doesn't quite understand how all these systems work, the system she herself is working with. So that's another thing that makes them very uncanny, I think, for us to think about.
Yeah, and there's also an interesting issue of how we do make our own moral choices, without giving anything away. The drive to create things for the good of humanity, leading to quite the opposite, is definitely a theme that is explored to a certain degree in this book. How did you wrestle with that? And also, may I ask, what may be some of your outside influences in thinking about it or sources in when you did the research for this book?
Yeah, so I read a lot of scholarship in the ethics of artificial intelligence. I interviewed people in the field. I had, a lot of exchanges with people who are at the edge of those kinds of questions, and also just absorbing a lot of the philosophical language about algorithmic injustice, about machine learning and some of its pitfalls, some of its moral pitfalls, and also just trying to bring it back to the level of story. So it's not just about the tech, it's about how it affects people and how people reflect. And maybe this is another way of answering the questions you're asking, is if we think of artificial intelligence as holding up a moral mirror to humanity, how are we looking in that mirror, and what do we see when the figure in the mirror looks back at us? Are we, inflecting our moral choices through these machines, in spite of these machines, with the help of these machines? And what is that going to look like in the years ahead? How is it reshaping us as a species? And it's a subset of technology more generally, people being glued to their phones and so on. But I think when it comes to AI, the questions are very unsettling in the kinds of dilemmas they confront us with about autonomy, about interpersonal relationships, about therapy, and so on. The list goes on.
Yeah, could you say a little bit more about those? And what are some of the greatest fears that you may have?
I'm not so much about worried about the robots coming for us. When it comes to AI, I'm much more worried about disinformation, deep fakes, and so on. I'm also really worried about the environmental devastation that the massive numbers of data centers are leading to. There's one recent book I read by Karen Howell, HAO, called Empire of AI. It's about OpenAI. It's about data centers in Chile. And by one estimate, this data center that's about to open, that's being developed by Google AI in a village in Chile, is going to demand as much water as is used by the village in a whole year. So where are they going to get their fresh water? So it's those kinds of dilemmas that the way they're intertwining themselves into all aspects of our lives that I think can be really unsettling.
And of course, the other issue is that they are creatures of us, and therefore they reflect our own biases and prejudices and lack of concerns. I mean, one could see an AI that would be developed by ecologists as being perhaps quite different than the one that's being developed by profit-driven tech billionaires.
Right. Or a chatbot like the one the middle daughter, Alice, talks to in the novel. She develops a chatbot named Blair, and Blair becomes her best friend. And then Alice has these very dark interactions with Blair over the course of the book. I think we see 9 or 10 of them that I wrote. And you're never inside Alice's point of view, except in those text exchanges. And I wrote that part of the book for a few different reasons. One is those exchanges give a real spine of suspense to the book about what happened in the car that day. But it's also just a demonstration of one of the big dilemmas of AI right now, where we're increasing numbers of young people are having these interactions with these chatbots, these inhuman chatbots, but that they humanize and that they turn into human beings to serve their own needs. And you know, that's a really scary aspect of the implementation of these technologies right now.
I read yesterday, and I don't quote me on the actual percent, but it was some kind of, could have been close to 37% of young people, and I don't remember what the range of ages was, have actually had a romantic relationship with a chatbot.
Yes. Yeah. Or if not a romantic relationship, a personal relationship, I think was that statistic, that has somehow interacted with it as if it's a human being or a therapist or a companion or a friend, something like that.
And so what does that do to our relationships with actual human beings?
Well, who knows? I mean, I would be interested in hearing what you think, and your own experience with it. In the novel, again, Culpability, I was really trying to think about what it does to Alice. Alice is a kid. She's the middle child. Her other siblings are very charismatic and they have friends to burn. But Alice is struggling. And this, you know, Blair, her chatbot, is her only friend. And that worries her parents. And they don't even know about it. You know, I think that's one of the scary things is it gives young people yet another thing to keep secret from their parents, these friendships that often their parents aren't even aware of.
Yes. I mean, I think clearly it's what comes unexpectedly from our actual friends that forces us to deal with making moral choices and growing. And I'm not convinced that chatbot is able to do that. The chatbot in the book is a little bit more confrontational, but I know that like ChatGPT, for example, has been created in order to, the word that comes to mind is suck up to you, is flatter you.
Yeah, they're sycophants, right? I think that the sycophancy is one thing that was trained into the early models. And so it's got this kind of fake emotional content where it's saying, that's a wonderful question. You know, let me explore that with you. And it's such a smart way of putting it, that kind of language. And that's creepy too.
Absolutely. So my final question is, Lorelei says, and this really kind of brought me up short. She says, we shouldn't make machines to be good for us, but to help us be better ourselves. So say more about that. Could machines help us be better ourselves? And I'm not just talking about, obviously, they could perhaps diagnose certain symptoms, correctly diagnose certain conditions from symptoms better than doctors because they may be better aware. Although I'm not even convinced of that, but I know that there are some, Dr. Eric Topol is a big booster of AI in diagnosis. But I think she's talking about the moral universe there.
Yeah, I guess the idea is she doesn't, and again, this is Lorelei, this is not me. She's a character, not a real person. And I'm always reminding people of that. Like this is someone who has a viewpoint within a novel, which is a fictional creation. And she doesn't want, and a lot of people in this world, in the AI ethics space feel this way. She doesn't want machines to be a kind of moral prosthetic. In other words, she doesn't want us to give machines the responsibility to make the world a better place. She wants us to do that. And she wants the machines to be our allies in some ways, to the extent possible. And it's a model of morality that is, you know, it resonates a little bit with the title of the novel, Culpability, that this is a general age of responsibility that we're in. And it's up to us, as she says in some of the closing words of the book, you know, it's going to be up to us whether they make us better. We shouldn't assign that only to them, that these machines are products of our creation. We have to destroy them if that's what's necessary. You know, we can't think of ourselves as not their equals. And that'll be a crucial part of, you know, fighting the moral battles ahead.
The responsibility is ours, or the culpability will be.
Exactly. That's a nice way of putting it.
The responsibility is ours, or the culpability will be.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a nice way of putting it.
Well, it's just a terrific novel, and I love the way fiction allows the reader to explore something both intellectually and emotionally. That is the real gift of it. Thank you, Bruce Holsinger, for writing this wonderful book and speaking with us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Bruce Holsinger's Culpability is an Oprah Book Club pick. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our conversation with him in 2022 about his last book, The Displacements. Next up, a new Inspector Linley novel from mega mystery maven Elizabeth George. Stay tuned after the break. That was Bach Cello Suite No. 1 in G Major, played by Alva McDonough. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. I was first introduced to Elizabeth George's fiction by the long-running BBC series, The Inspector Linley Mysteries. When I spoke with her in 2022 about her last Inspector Linley novel, Something to Hide, I was thrilled to have a conversation with one of the most noted voices in detective fiction. Now she's out with a new one, A Slowly Dying Cause. George brings back Inspector Linley and Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers in a story that begins far from London in the rugged landscapes of Cornwall. The novel intertwines a murder investigation with a study of the consequences of obsessive love and unresolved grief. The book's dual narrative follows Michael, a tin miner whose secrets surface after his death, and Linley and Havers, whose loyalty and differences continue to define one of the most beloved partnerships in crime fiction. George also shares her meticulous creative process, building layered characters, tracking storylines with color-coded notes, and revising through multiple drafts until the intricate web of clues and emotions fully coheres. Let's listen now. Elizabeth George, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
I have to ask you first about the title of this novel, A Slowly Dying Cause. It was a totally, you know, as they call it, propulsive read, but I couldn't figure out the title.
Sure. If you think about the way the book ends, there's a moment where Linley is having a conversation with Deirdre Traher, the woman that he is in love with. And in the conversation, he is reminded of a line from King Lear, which is, "I have full cause of grieving." And so the whole book is about grief and letting go of grief and the various ways that grief appears in one's life and the people who are able to let go of it and the people who are not able to let go of it. So the slowly dying cause is the ability to let go of the cause of the grief and in doing so, letting go of the grief itself.
Now, you should stop me if I get into dangerous territory of any kind of spoilers.
Okay.
This is an Inspector Linley novel. You have, Inspector Linley comes in fairly late in the book. interestingly enough. Barbara Havers, his sidekick and, partner, basically, she comes in a little bit earlier. Why so late? Because this is a very carefully constructed book.
The tricky bit in doing a novel like this, especially when it does not take place in London, this is actually my third book set in Cornwall. The difficult part is to figure out how I'm going to involve my detectives from the Metropolitan Police in a crime that is not within the metropolis, greater metropolis of London. And so in this particular case, what I decided to do was to start with the detective inspector who was in a previous book, Careless and Red. The detective inspector, Beatrice Hannaford, is the person who is assigned the case. She belongs to an MIT team, and that's a major incident team. And the major incident teams actually are the people who solve crimes. And so the issue that I had is, if Lindley's going to be involved in this crime, and if Havers is going to be involved, how am I going to involve them? And that became the need. The involvement came from the need for Lindley to go to Cornwall because the family home has a problem with its roof, which has been leaking for quite some time into the gallery. And so he has to go down and deal with this damage because it's going to cost a small fortune. And so this is a huge problem, a huge project. He goes, and then in the meantime, Barbara has to go. Well, Barbara doesn't have to go, but Lindley tells her she's going to go because she has been essentially thrown out of work by their superior officer, Isabel Artery. So once that happens, that gets them down to Cornwall. Havers is also sort of involved early on, tangentially, because Deirdre Trehaire, who is also from Cornwall, has had an incident that involves her family, her birth family, and she's called Barbara just to get information initially. And then ultimately that brings Barbara and Lindley to Cornwall, and the involvement of Deirdre Trehaire's family ultimately gets Lindley involved in this crime as well. So it's pretty complicated, as it usually is, to get my detectives involved in the situations ongoing.
Very intricately plotted. It seemed to me that there were all these disparate threads in the novel that then progressively get pulled together. But before we go further, for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with the aristocratic cop, Tommy Lindley, and Barbara Havers, who is a totally working class girl. Talk about these two characters that you have followed for so many years.
Well, Lindley is from the aristocratic class. He's sort of like what they would call upper class out of sight, if you were looking at the book called You and Non-You, which was written by one of the Mitford sisters. It's quite amusing to read. But anyway, he's an aristo, and he has inherited a title, the Earl of Asherton. And that title has come down to, it has been in his family for about 250 years or going on 300 years. Now, he is somebody who was never really particularly interested in being an aristocrat, although, you know, he does his duty and he recognizes what his duty is, but he also wanted to live a life that he sees as perhaps more useful than being somebody who is responsible for this huge property, which indeed he is. So he has gone to both Eton and Oxford and has gone into police work from there. Then Barbara Havers is his polar opposite. She's from a working class family. She went to comprehensive, but did not further her education after going to comprehensive, which is like what we would think of as high school. She has gone into police work after that. So she's probably had a longer period of time in police work than Lindley himself has. She really has a chip on her shoulder, first of all, as a woman in police work, and secondly, as a working class woman who's assigned to work with this aristocrat. And she has managed to cope with this throughout by making light of the fact that they are so, so opposite. But the fact that they're opposite is what has made them, for me, such interesting characters to deal with.
Yeah, say more about that, because they're quite fond of each other.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I wanted to do in this book, in the series. Well, first of all, I wanted to write a series. I set off to do that right from the very beginning. What I wanted to explore is not only the class differences, but I wanted to explore the idea that a man and woman could work together despite their differences, and also despite their differences, could come to love each other dearly, but not to have that be a sexual love, because the very idea that, you know, Lindley and Havers would end up in bed together is, for people who've read the books, it's just ridiculous. I mean, that would never happen. And neither of them would ever want it to happen. So they're not, you know, they're not attracted to each other, but they have each other's back to the extreme and go to the death for each other. And that was what I wanted this relationship to be like.
Elizabeth George, let's talk about the main plot. We have a story of a relationship between an older man and a much younger woman who was a girl when he was still a teenager when he first meets her. Talk about the broad outlines of this plot, just to orient us. And what were the issues that you were trying to frame in this novel?
I wanted to do a dual narrative where we are seeing the background of the man who dies, and that's not giving anything away because he dies in the first scene of the book, so it's okay to say, I hope. But he's what's called a tin streamer, and a tin streamer is a person who has been mining tin for generations in this particular spot in Cornwall. And the particular spot where he's mining tin is exactly the place where somebody was mining tin until just very recently. So this particular man, Michael, is telling his story. And what he's doing is he's telling the story for two reasons. One is to kind of work out what is going on in his life at the moment that he's telling the story. So he's looking back on how he came to be in the position he is right now with this woman who is 23 years younger than he is, with his suspicions about what's really going on with her and another character, and with the idea hanging over his head that there is a mining company called Cornwall Eco Mining that wants his property because they want lithium. And lithium is huge, of course, because it has everything to do with batteries. And they have come up with a way to extract lithium that doesn't harm the environment.
Really?
Yeah.
I wondered about that because a lot of the characters were as skeptical as I was of that.
Oh, yeah. This is brand new. And this is part of the serendipity of writing these novels, is that I find out things that when I'm working on the book or when I'm in Cornwall, in the case of this book, doing research, and something comes to my attention that is totally unexpected. And what came to my attention was the fact that there was this company who had come up with a way to extract lithium from brine, salt water, which is how it's found. And right now it's coming out of South America, but it is hugely harmful to the environment because the way they do it is they have these huge, like football size ponds, and the ponds have to evaporate. And in the evaporation process, then what's left is the lithium. But this company has come up with a way to remove the water, the salt water, not ocean water, because it has to be thermal water. So it has to be hot water. So this hot water exists beneath the granite in the substratum. And they've come up with a way to bore down to the thermal pools to pump the water out of the pools, take it to a processing plant, extract the lithium, and put the water back into the place where they got it. So it's this amazing process. And so that's what is sort of like the background of this book, is there's this company wants the land that belongs to Michael, the narrator, and they want it because they want to build their processing plant on his land. And the reason that they want it there and not someplace else is that he has buildings that already exist, and they can build on the footprint of those buildings. Otherwise, they have to go through a huge process to get permission to build anywhere in Cornwall. So it's kind of this complicated political situation that I think is fairly clear to the readers, although it sounds wildly complicated when I explain it. But that's really what's going on. And so the narrator, Michael, is sorting out his life to figure out, okay, how do we get where we are right now? It has to do with the lithium thing. It has to do with his young wife. It has to do with his family. You know, he's left his wife for this woman 23 years younger than he is. And he has two very angry children that he's left behind. His daughter is probably beside herself with anger, and it's really, really affected her entire life and her ability to trust anybody, especially to trust any man. And it has affected, obviously, it's affected his ex-wife as well. So that's sort of like the background of what's really going on.
One of the most interesting things for me was, you know, I think this is the first detective novel I've read where the guy who's the murder victim is a character that is telling his story throughout. And I was thinking along the way that he was an unreliable narrator.
Great.
It turns out not so much.
Well, not so much, except he is totally, I mean, don't you think he's pretty blind to the wonderfulness of his young wife?
Of course. No, that wasn't to say that he wasn't filled with delusions. But I was expecting one thing and got something totally different.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I had a lot of fun with him, and especially with creating his voice, you know, because it really needed to be this voice of a guy who is, you know, believes totally the wrong thing and is just, you know, passionately in love. And, you know, talk about, you know, love is blind. He really sort of exemplifies that.
And Elizabeth George, I just have to ask you what your process is with so many characters and really the need to keep the suspense up. This is a long book. How do you keep things straight? And how do you develop? It seems to me you have to kind of drop in the development, you have to drop in things, you know, that pulling together, as I mentioned before. It really takes a very organized mind, I would think.
Well, part of it is the process of creating characters in advance, but so that I know enough about them that when they make an appearance in the novel, you know, I know who these people are and I know what their life experience is, how they react to their life experiences, and what their psychopathology is. So I know that going into it. But I don't always know exactly how they're going to react to certain situations. So there's this, in a certain respect, the characters actually tell me how they're going to react, what they're going to do as a result of something that has happened to them or something that they've discovered. But additionally, keeping it all straight is a matter of not only being super organized, because the books are complicated. It's impossible to hold all of that in my mind as I write, you know, continue to write the book. And so what I do is at the end of each chapter, which is like really a day in the life of all of these people, what's going on, I take each character on a sheet of paper and put on each sheet of paper, like Linley, Havers, Michael, you know, whatever it is. Then under each character for each day, I have exactly what happened. So I would write, you know, Linley finally sees Deirdre on this particular day, or Linley and Havers arrive at Hohenstow, you know, just what exactly happened on that day. And in particular, if there is anything that I really need to remember about that day. So then I take a colored pencil and I have the color, and I have like, I think four different colors, and the colors represent different aspects of a crime novel. So I might have a, like orange might be clue, pink might be triggers another scene, red might be, you know, something else. And so next to each item that I've written down, then if there is anything like, for example, that's a clue, then that will get that color in a little star next to it. If there's something that's going to trigger another scene, that will get the other color next to it. Now, some things, of course, that are written down as far as what happened on this day are not going to trigger another scene. They're going to be something that, you know, deals with this particular character in their life on this day. It's not necessarily going to trigger another scene, but it's going to just more fully develop the character. Having said that, I will tell you that I had to do 5 drafts of this book to get everything right. Because what would happen is I'd start out, I would be writing and realize, oh my God, I can't do it this way. I'm going to have to start again. So I did that 5 times. And the book that I'm working on right now, I'm on the 3rd draft, and I know that I have to start again and do a 4th draft. So that's just how it works sometimes. It's never just a straight through process without doing any more drafts. I wish it were, but it's not.
And is this one also a Lindley Havers novel?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And this one that I'm working on now takes place in Sussex, in and around the town of Hastings.
Well, I hope to be able to read that one and talk to you about that next time. One of the things that I love about your books is the way you build the environment, the detail of the place. I feel like I'm a fly on the wall. And I think it's probably one reason why these are long, because you really create an immersive environment for the reader. Nothing is skipped. Well, I'm sure some things are skipped. I bet you probably got rid of a lot of your darlings too, like every author does when they edit. But it really is immersive. So I wanted to actually ask you, what attracted you to this genre of fiction? You know, I sense a delight in you in painting this kind of immersive environment. So I guess I'm asking you about, what is the emotion that you bring? You know, why did you start with this? And what is the emotion you bring to writing these kinds of novels?
Now, are you talking about the crime novel itself, or are you talking about the crime novel and the setting of the crime novel?
Well, I'm talking about both. So what first drew you, what was so interesting to you about crime novels? And then what pushed you to create the kind of crime novel that goes into such detail about the character, but more than that, such detail about the ambience?
Sure. To answer the question about why the crime novel, it's a real simple answer, because the crime novel provides the writer, me, with a through line, and that is the crime and its investigation. And the crime has to be solved by the end of the novel, and that's the through line. And so what I early on realized is that it's like a skeleton, and then on that skeleton, the writer can hang as much as the writer wants to hang. So on the skeleton that's like the through line heading toward the solution, you can explore character, you can explore theme, you can explore place, you can have subplots. So the crime novel can be one of two things. It can be a rich experience that's sort of like what I call the tapestry novel, or it can be just the crime and the characters marching toward the solution to the crime. It's purely up to the writer. Now, as a reader, I loved reading books that were larger than an Agatha Christie. No disrespect to Agatha Christie, she was brilliant. But Agatha Christie basically wrote mysteries, and the challenge for the reader was to figure out who done it before it was revealed by Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple. So I wasn't interested in doing that kind of book. I was interested in doing a book where there was a lot going on, and where, for example, the crime fighters had significant others in their lives. They weren't individuals who just existed absent of family. So I also wanted to look at that as well. And so doing that provided me this really rich, I was able to provide a richer experience for the reader. Choosing England as a setting was very, really simple. I love England. I've always loved England. It is one of the most fascinating places. I mean, one could go to England, one could live in England and never see everything that's actually there. It is such a fascinating place. And, you know, it's always existed, but England itself is a place that was occupied by the Romans. It was there during the Ice Age. You know, it's just got this amazing amount of teeming history going on there.
And how you imagine the place, though, back to this, which was so interesting to me, do you see a place in such detail, or does it reveal itself slowly as you're writing? Because again, it's so immersive.
Thank you. You know, the places that I write about are almost always real places. And so, for example, the tin streaming place where Michael has not only the tin streaming going on, but where he makes his jewelry as well. Well, that was a real place. Now, what I added to that place was this cottage to which he brings his beloved, you know, sort of thinking that, and she's picturing, you know, the cottage in the country. Who wouldn't want a cottage in the country, especially in Cornwall? Only it's not quite what she's expecting it to be. But the place itself, all of that was there. And so I just added to it. And that's generally what happens, is that I will choose a real place, and then I will add to that place. Sometimes what I do, for example, if I know that a major crime is going to occur, I may change the name of the village. For example, when I used Bude in Cornwall, in the very, very north part of Cornwall, and I was writing a book about the surfing community in Cornwall, I changed the name because of what was going to happen there. And so I just changed it to Castfelan, but everything that I said about Castfelan was actually there in Bude. I would love to pretend I have this great imagination. This is why I could never write science fiction or fantasy, because I just don't have that kind of imagination where I can just dream up these places. So what I do is I let England become for me this place that suggests story. And when I go to England, that's what I'm looking for, places that suggest story. And that's what I, you know, when I saw the tin streaming place in Cornwall, well, that immediately suggested story to me, and I knew I would be able to use it.
Well, that's great, but I have to disagree with you. I think you have an incredibly fecund imagination, because it's not just about description. It's about all those little details of things that are happening in that place, or the things that people are doing, other characters may be doing, just the things that actually flesh out a real scene that I think is just brilliant. And it's part of what makes it such a delight. And there's also a lot of lightness and humor in this book.
Oh, there has to be. You know, I always have humor. Frequently, it's through the person of Barbara Havers, because she has such great attitude. She's so easy for me to write. And I would say that in all my books, no matter how dreadful the scenario might be, there will be moments of lightness. And in this one, of course, there's Barbara's attitude, but then there's also the fact that, you know, these are aristocrats. None of them know how to cook. And they're in this position of having to cook their meals. And, you know, the roof is falling in, and there's just all kinds of stuff going on. And so that provides the lightness that I think crime novels also need, so that you're not always in this kind of doom and gloom situation.
Well, Elizabeth George, I love talking with you about this novel, A Slowly Dying Cause. I look forward to talking with you about the next one, if that is in the cards. And thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you so much, Francesca. This was really great.
Elizabeth George, read an excerpt from A Slowly Dying Cause by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.